Good morning or afternoon, whichever floats your boat. My name is Ariana. I am the new assistant to Terrible Tommy. My job is to seek out interesting and valuable information to relate to you. I don't label it right or left, conservative or liberal. My job is to decide whether it has a ring of truth or not. We all know there's tons of BS, and sometimes, like the chickens in the barnyard, you have to peck around like hell to get a piece of corn out of a pile of bullshit. So here we go, let's see what exciting information we can educate you with today.
Well, boys, do the LA Sheriff's Department have a problem? Or the LA Police Department have a problem? There's secret societies within the department. I wonder where they came from. Are they Mexican? Are they black? Are they Aryan? Whoops, Aryan, you think? I don't know, could be.
LA County paid $55 million in settlements related to alleged sheriff's deputy gangs. Figure comes from list of claims involving tattooed groups of deputies who revel in aggressive policing over the past 10 years. The county has paid out nearly $21 million in cases. Vikings, Regulators, 3000 Boys, and Banditos are some of the names of alleged deputy gangs which have operated out of several sheriff's department stations. Critics say some of the tactics are similar to those used by criminal street gangs. Some of the cases involve incidents that date as far back as 1990. Multiple investigations are now underway, including one by the FBI. Los Angeles County has paid roughly $55 million in settlements in cases in which sheriff's deputies were alleged to belong to a secret society. The records that were obtained by the Los Angeles Times shed light on a subculture that has plagued the sheriff's department for decades. The multi-million dollar figure was arrived at using a list that registered the payouts in dozens of lawsuits and claims that saw deputies associated with tattooed groups who were accused of glorifying an aggressive style of policing. The list totals almost 60 cases in all, with some claims still in progress. The gangs were dragged into the spotlight most recently after the LA Times reported that the Banditos, which operated out of the East LA station, ended up knocking a deputy unconscious during an off-duty party in 2018. A mouse and mouse pad appear to have the design from the tattoo. In a claim filed against Los Angeles County, Deputy Sheriff Ostriver to Gonzalez claims the Compton station is plagued by a gang of officers who terrorize other deputies and threaten to not enforce laws so they can get preferred treatment. +7 in a claim filed against Los Angeles County, Deputy Sheriff Ostriver to Gonzalez claims the Compton station is plagued by a gang of officers who terrorize other deputies and threaten to not enforce laws so they can get preferred treatment. 8 specific cliques are also mentioned by name, including the Vikings, Regulators, 3000 Boys, and the Banditos. The deputy groups are alleged to have been operating for decades out of jails and sheriff's department stations, exhibiting behavior not dissimilar to street gangs. No matter who has been in charge at the top of the LAPD, the groups have always failed to be brought under control despite numerous internal investigations and a probe by the FBI. I think it's a willful failure, said John Sweeney, a lawyer who has represented families of people killed by deputies to the Times. For some reason, they pride themselves, the sheriff's department, on having these violent cliques, I guess, to show the public who's the boss. But, you know, what it does is just fosters a horrible relationship between the community that these sheriffs serve. Poll reveals 39% of black Americans are not confident they. Mariah Carey's estranged sister Allison accuses their mother. Share this article. Share the groups were dragged into the spotlight after the LA Times reported that the banditos, which operated out of the East LA station, ended up knocking a deputy unconscious during an off-duty party in 2018. The Los Angeles County Sheriff announced an inquiry into supposed secret gangs of deputies sporting matching skeleton tattoos operating with the department plus seven. The Los Angeles County Sheriff announced an inquiry into supposed secret gangs of deputies sporting matching skeleton tattoos operating with the department at Compton Sheriff Station. There are 20 Inc. members of the Executioner's Gang in the station, and another 20 who are prospective members or close associates. The Inc. members have matching tattoos, a skull with Nazi imagery, holding an AK-47, that indicate their affiliation with the gang, Deputy Sheriff Austriberto Gonzalez alleged in a claim. There are no black or female members. The claim details that the executioners operate at CPT with impunity, with members acting out against their fellow deputies and the public to increase their standing in the organization. Nearly all the members have a matching tattoo to symbolize their status in the gang, comprised of a skull with Nazi imagery and an AK-47. The firearm is heavily associated with gang activity and not with law enforcement, the claim states. Members become inked as executioners after executing members of the public, or otherwise committing acts of violence in furtherance of the gang, the claim alleges. Those involved in fatal shootings are immediately tatted during one of the many inking parties. The deputy also accused the gang of threatening work slowdowns by disregarding radio calls or responding to them slowly, as well as instituting illegal arrest quotas, if they did not get their desired schedules or assignments. In February, Sheriff Alex Villanueva said that there were now measures that had been put in place to prohibit deputies from taking part in cliques. The skeleton tattoo design also includes the letters CPT, which is short for Compton. The officers with tattoo are posted to the LAPD Compton station. The skeleton tattoo design also includes the letters CPT, which is short for Compton. The officers with tattoo are posted to the LAPD Compton station. Pictured, Compton, California City Attorney Damon Brown, left, with Mayor Aya Brown, standing right, calls on the State Attorney General's Office and the U.S. Department of Justice to investigate the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Station at a news conference in Compton on Tuesday, plus 7 Compton, California City Attorney Damon Brown, left, with Mayor Aya Brown, standing right, calls on the State Attorney General's Office and the U.S. Department of Justice to investigate the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Station at a news conference in Compton on Tuesday. Sheriff Alex Villanueva released a statement declaring there was no gang at the department but announced that an investigation was underway. Plus 7 Sheriff Alex Villanueva released a statement declaring there was no gang at the department but announced that an investigation was underway. Last week during a Facebook Live event, he said that there is no gang of any deputies running any station. But he later issued a statement saying he takes the allegations seriously and recently published a policy specifically addressing illicit groups, deputy cliques, and subgroups. The fact that I've had to address these issues, which have been festering since 1990, is an illustration of the failure of past sheriffs from addressing the issue head on, he said in a statement. But it doesn't appear to have solved the problem entirely. Inspector General Max Huntsman said that he was not aware of any of Villanueva's new measures being implemented and that any attempt to investigate the secret societies was essentially blocked by the Sheriff's Department. Multiple investigations are now underway, including one by the FBI.
Well, what do you think of that? Whoa! There's no joy in Mudville. We got some bad hombres in the Sheriff's Department and the L.A. Police Department. All kinds of people. Got the Pachucos, and looks like we got the Aryans, too. But don't tell anybody. They've been in there a long time. Thanks, Horrible Harry, for that one. How about this? Here's 10 security myths which you should not believe in about your internet and problems on the internet. Ready, set, go.
10 security myths you should stop believing. Cybercrime is one of the fastest growing criminal enterprises in this era. It makes around $1.5 trillion in profits a year, and that's a liberal estimate, according to a 2019 study. So, what are some of the most profitable goods, so to speak, that are sold online? It turns out that stolen data is at the top of the list. This data comes from companies, organizations, and even people like you. That's right, hackers want data from everybody, not just high-powered executives or wealthy people. One of the biggest ways cybercriminals make bank is by selling username and password combinations to websites, subscriptions, and even bank accounts. This is why it's critical for you to have strong cybersecurity habits. Luckily, we've got a guide on all you need to know about staying secure online. But another good way to stay safe is by being aware of misinformation. There are tons of myths swirling around that keep people vulnerable and help hackers steal your data, so today we're diving into 10 common misconceptions you should watch out for. 1. I don't have anything worth protecting. You might think your data isn't worth anything. You might think that since you have nothing to hide, there's no point in protecting your identity or information. This mistaken idea helps cybercriminals crawl their way into your digital world and steal your secrets. Think about it this way: all those free social media apps you sign up for, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, aren't really free at all. When you sign the terms and conditions, you're signing away your right to privacy, which lets the apps build a detailed, demographic profile of you. The companies turn around and sell this information to marketers. That means your information is making these companies millions of dollars. So why wouldn't hackers want to cash in on that? This is only the tip of the iceberg, though. If you've got an iPhone, a webcam, or even Microsoft Word, hackers have a way to break into your computer and steal all that information you deem unimportant, all of which will make them a pretty penny on the dark web. 2. I use security software, so that's good enough. Many people think that security software will act as an invincible shield between their data and hackers. In reality, antivirus providers are at just as much risk as you are. Just last year, a Russian group of hackers breached servers of 3 major antivirus providers. Now, all the information they stole is up for sale on the dark web. So, what's a good way to work around this danger? One of your options is to double up on protection. Just as two heads are better than one, so too are two different security programs. This way you've got multiple shields between your data and bad faith actors. 3. My data was already breached. I have nothing to protect now, so you found out that you've already been a victim to a security breach. You may feel hopeless, and like there's no point in protecting your data since it's already been overtaken. That's not true. There are different types of data breaches that can have different impacts. For example, say your password and username to your bank account has been breached. Don't give up. Inaction empowers the hackers to pry for even more information, which could lead them to your social security number. You need to take immediate action, see if anyone's trying to commit identity fraud or run a free credit report. Here are more steps you can take to make sure you can protect the privacy you have left. 4. Phishing scams are easy to spot. This is not always the case. Phishing scams are becoming more and more sophisticated as hackers infiltrate companies, CEOs' personal accounts, and even government agencies. In fact, phishing scams have skyrocketed during COVID-19. It's not always as simple as an unfamiliar account reaching out to you with bizarre messages trying to get you to click on a link. Sometimes, they use familiar faces against you, which leads to the next myth. 5. My friends on social media won't hurt me. The great thing about social media is that it connects you with all of your friends and relatives. Unfortunately, the web of connectivity can be an opening for spiders to turn friends into gateways for data breaches. Say your friend has a weak password, and their account gets breached. Say they send you a private message saying they found a funny new video or a cool new site you should check out. Since the link is coming from a familiar face, your guards may be down. After all, you're aware of phishing scams when you get a message from someone you've never heard of, but you don't have that on your mind when you hear from a friend. Hackers bank on those lowered guards to corrupt your web and turn it into a jumping point for even more data breaches. 6. Hackers are mysterious, scary figures who lurk in dark rooms with hoodies. When you think of a hacker, you probably imagine popular images of hooded figures hunched over a computer. Actually, a lot of hackers are normal people and can be hard to spot. It's important to realize that hackers aren't lone wolves. There are entire organizations, often government-funded, that work together to infiltrate data and rake in millions. Hacking is also a popular way for mobsters to bring in cash at long distances. Once you realize just how dire this threat is, it becomes easy to understand why taking steps towards cybersecurity is so important. 7. I only go to mainstream sites, so I don't need security software. You need security software no matter where you go. Remember what I said earlier, about how social media apps sell your data to make their money. The more cookies you have in your browser, the more your every step is being followed. When multiple sites have a detailed profile of you, that increases your chances of getting your data breached, since all companies are vulnerable to a data breach. Security software keeps you safe. It's like two-factor authentication, a necessary step towards protecting your privacy. Related, 3 security programs that should be on every computer and laptop. 8. I use complex passwords, so I am not a target in today's security landscape. Even a long, complicated password isn't enough to keep you safe. Nowadays, there are speedy programs people use to run billions of password combinations, and it only takes a second to run these potential passwords. Not only that, but hackers have sophisticated methods for identifying passwords we use in password creation. That's why you should also use password managers as well as two-factor authentication. 9. I know a fake voice when I hear one. You've probably heard of this. Scammers often call you with robotic voices, pretending to be the IRS. They demand money. You may think you can recognize a robotic voice, but unfortunately, robocallers are improving their techniques. Deepfake technology can replicate more than just faces. It's also expanding into voices. Online programs need only to hear your voice to create a close copy. 10. I will know when something bad gets in my device or computer. You never know what could be lurking on your computer.
Whoa. Almost went to sleep there, boys and girls.
Yeah, I didn't get much sleep last night. Sometimes that happens. Well, here's an excellent article by William Pierce, Dr. William Pierce.
Editors note, this excellent article accurately describes the state of the U.S. today, but was written in 1970. William Luther Pierce was a brilliant essayist and speaker whose message didn't get through to most Americans because of the media monopolies of the time, but who saw clearly what was happening to America. What is the establishment? Why, that's easy, you say. The establishment is those persons, taken collectively, who run the system. But who are those persons? What are their names? What, if anything, do they have in common? How did they get into the establishment in the first place? Is one born into it? Is it something like a fraternity or a secret society? Is great wealth a prerequisite for admission? Or is membership in the establishment a prerequisite for owning great wealth in America? Dr. William Luther Pierce. There is a great deal of confusion on these questions because of the sloppy but prevalent tendency to equate prestige and status, i.e., social rank, with power in our society. Things don't necessarily work that way. It is clear that the one meaningful criterion for distinguishing members of the establishment from non-members is power, power to make independent decisions which directly affect the operation of the system. In applying this criterion, however, it is essential to distinguish between apparent power, or power of a purely formal sort, and real power. Military-industrial complex as an example. Consider the oft-mentioned military-industrial complex. The standard rhetoric on the subject would lead one to the conclusion that the brass hats, the generals and the admirals who make up the military side of the complex, are powerful men and, hence, part of the establishment. But, as a matter of fact, this conclusion is false. Most generals and admirals exercise virtually no influence on the system. The average general may have a lot of tanks and guns to play with. An admiral may command a mighty aircraft carrier or a whole fleet of secretaries and typists in the Pentagon. But one thing these men may not do is make independent decisions. All their gold braid does not change the fact that they are mere pawns in the game, and rather rigidly restricted pawns, at that. Being allowed to decide whether next Tuesday's mission will be to blow up Village A instead of Village B in Vietnam does not constitute real power, in the system sense. Neither does having the authority to write a purchase order for 1 million mess kits, aluminum, collapsible. This is not to say that there is no truth in the Colonel Blimp caricatures of the military bureaucrat, or that much of what's wrong in public life today is not exemplified in the Pentagon hierarchy. But the example of Douglas MacArthur should serve to illustrate what can happen when a general begins to get ideas too big for his brass hat. Similar considerations apply to much of the industrial side of the military-industrial complex, although the industrialists, because they have money, must be scrutinized more carefully than the generals. There is no denying the fact that any man with $500 million in the bank, provided he is also moderately clever, has a definite potential for calling the tune. Nevertheless, it is surprising how little correlation there is between personal wealth and real power in most cases. In the first place, the manufacturer who owns a $100 million tire factory by no means necessarily has $100 million in financial weight to throw around. His liquid assets, available for buying politicians, silencing critics, influencing elections, etc., will generally be much smaller than his fixed assets, such as land, buildings, and machinery. He may find himself hard-pressed just keeping his employees' union bought off, the IRS off his back, and his yacht afloat. The average industrialist makes his contribution to the system not so much by pulling the strings as merely by playing along with it through his own money-grubbing self-interest. His control over our lives is largely mechanical: the filth his factories pour into the air we breathe and the water we drink, the honking, flashing, screeching asphalt and neon jungle he has built for us to live in. The control exercised over our lives by the system and, thus, by the men of the establishment is much more profound. It reaches into our minds and our souls and twists our wills to its own ends. It manipulates us and subtly persuades us. It corrupts us and robs us of our strength and our virtue. And, when its purpose is so served, it coldly snuffs out our lives by the millions. The war makers, the military-industrial complex, may glory in wars and it may profit from them, but it is the establishment, not the generals and the factory owners, which makes the basic decisions as to whether there shall be a war and when and against whom. American involvement in both world wars gives us an excellent example of how the establishment works. Neither in World War I nor in World War II were the interests of the American people served by intervention in European conflicts. Yet, in 1917 Wilson dragged a reluctant America into a European war, and 24 years later Roosevelt managed the same thing. In both cases the principal actors had been re-elected to the presidency immediately beforehand on a platform of pacifism and non-intervention. And in both cases the mass media, principally the press, in that pre-TV era had played the vital role of swinging public opinion into line behind the newly elected instant warriors. But neither Wilson nor Roosevelt were the ultimate decision makers. Nor was it the generals or the industrialists. In both cases the decision makers, the men of the establishment, worked behind the scenes to further their own vital interests at the expense of the American people. And they exercised the necessary control over the system to prevail. In World War I those whose interests were served were the Zionists, who received England's pledge, as later expressed in the Balfour Declaration, to deliver Palestine to them. In return they brought about U.S. intervention in the war on the side of England. Their agents in this were Louis Brandeis, the Zionist Supreme Court Justice, who exerted his influence directly on Wilson, and a number of Jewish newspaper publishers who controlled a substantial portion of the American press. This Andy Warhol advertisement for a Jewish nose job, titled Before and After, was auctioned off in New York last month. An art collector paid $21,000 for it. More about this painting here, http://williamlutherpierce.blogspot.com/2012/04/andy-warhols-jewish-nose-job.html. In World War II, world Jewry was faced with its most serious crisis in centuries as National Socialist Germany moved to destroy Jewish power and influence in Europe. Again, the media played an enormously important role in conditioning the American people to accept the necessity of a European war. In the war hysteria generated after the fortuitous but not unforeseen Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, Roosevelt and the press were able to sweep the public along on a monumentally destructive and murderous crusade in Europe. We can again see the same process at work where the Middle Eastern war is concerned today. The omnipotent media, it is not the generals and it is not the industrialists who are responsible for the US backing Israel. Between them, they couldn't begin to talk the American people into another war now. But the media could and are. The generals and the munitions makers have clearly recognizable spheres of self-interest. Thus, even the most credulous elements of the public immediately discount anything they say. Unfortunately, the same is not true of the media. First, most people do not recognize that the media also, because of the tightly knit nature of the group which controls them, have a definite sphere of self-interest. Second, the media are truly, and inherently, Oriental in their subtlety. The average American thinks propaganda is what a plainly labeled spokesman for the system tells the people in order to keep them happy, win their support for a new government program, etc. He simply doesn't think anyone would be devious enough to try to accomplish the same thing with the Wednesday night movie, or the 6 o'clock news, or an Associated Press release, or the Sunday supplement in his morning paper. The pride of the media is their ability to create the illusion of a marketplace of diverse ideas and opinions, while in reality always representing only their own interests. Consider, for example, the spectrum of views presented by the media on the Middle East conflict. Some editorial writers are hot for all-out U.S. military support of Israel, while others feel a little less commitment would be more appropriate. Most commentators refer to the Fedayeen as terrorists, while some use the more neutral term guerrillas. And while some columnists rage about Arab aggression, others gently remind us of the miserable conditions in the Palestinian refugee camps. But can you name a single major newspaper in America which advocates that we back the Arabs rather than the Jews? And when was the last time you heard David Brinkley refer to Israeli commandos as terrorists? No choice indeed. We never get both sides of an issue from the media, but only various views of the same side. We are given the same sort of choice in forming our opinions that the Democrats and Republicans present to us every 4 years. In today's world, many things are important and represent power, money, the military, but the most important and powerful of all in a modern democracy is the mechanism for creating and controlling public opinion. The group which has this mechanism in its hands wields the ultimate authority. That group is the establishment, or, at least, the vital core of the establishment. And, in 20th century America, that group is predominantly Jewish. This may be hard to accept for those who have convinced themselves that the establishment is Standard Oil and the Pentagon. In the world of 100 years ago, that would have been the case. But today Mr. Rockefeller, despite all his millions and all his talent for deceit and all his conniving, grasping, unprincipled ambition, wields less power than, say, Sam Newhouse, of whom most Americans have never heard. M.R. Newhouse, the publicity-shunning son of Jewish immigrants from Russia, doesn't own Standard Oil. But he does own 28 big city daily newspapers, with a combined circulation of more than 5 million. The slanted news in one day's printing of the Washington Post or the New York Times carries more weight than all the memoranda ever issued by all the generals in the Pentagon. Needless to say, both these papers are in the hands of Jewish families. If one considers not only direct ownership but also indirect control through advertising revenue, which is the lifeblood of any newspaper, virtually every major daily newspaper in America is subject to the dictates of the Jewish establishment. Many true, we are living in the age of the mass media. It is an age in which new rules apply. No longer is it necessary, in order to control a nation, for a ruling clique to have a monopoly on the capital assets and the firepower of that nation. These days control is exercised more subtly, but all the more surely, by manipulating the thoughts and the opinions of the populace. Universal literacy, which makes every American a newspaper reader, and unprecedented prosperity, which has put a TV receiver in every home, ensure that the control will be all-pervasive. There is only one way to fight it, and that is to understand what it is and who exercises it, and then to go after them tooth and nail.
And that was Dr. William Pierce, deceased leader of the National Alliance Organization, one of the biggest in the country, if not the biggest, at the time. Well, let's see how the black boys are doing today. We got a pretty good article about the black boys.
The cries for justice over the deaths of Trayvon Martin and Michael Brown were hoaxes. Both men were criminals who died because they were dumb enough to assault men with guns. The same is true of Ahmaud Arbery. They got justice. Jussie Smollett and Bubba Wallace were hoaxers painting themselves as victims of hate crimes. But fake hate crimes are real hate crimes against whites. Both men's careers should be cancelled, and they should end up in jail for their crimes. There are more than 40 million black people in America. Can't Black Lives Matter find at least one actual victim of racism? Now, with the leak of the police body camera footage of the arrest of George Floyd, we have confirmation of what sensible people suspected all along. George Floyd was not a victim of police brutality or injustice. The story we had been sold was that, for no good reason, Floyd was thrown to the ground by a brutal cop, Derek Chauvin, who then put his knee on Floyd's neck for nearly 9 minutes while Floyd pled that he could not breathe, choking him to death. Based on this story, Derek Chauvin was fired and indicted for murder, and the three other cops who assisted him were fired and indicted for aiding and abetting murder. Also based on this story, America has been convulsed by more than 2 months of race riots, which have killed dozens, injured countless others, and destroyed billions of dollars in property and countless livelihoods. There were many facts that did not fit this story, however. George Floyd's autopsy revealed that he wasn't suffocated. Instead, he died of heart failure. He was suffering from heart disease and COVID-19. He also had the opioid fentanyl in his system as well as methamphetamine. The medical examiner said these drugs contributed to this death. He also had traces of cannabis. Beyond that, Floyd was apprehended before he could drive off, clearly intoxicated, after trying to pass a counterfeit bill. Should the police have allowed him to just drive away? Obviously not. They had to do something to get Floyd out of his car and away from the public so he could not endanger himself or others. The person who called the police reported that Floyd was acting strangely, which in all likelihood meant that he was intoxicated or mentally ill, thus not to be trifled with. It turns out that Floyd had a long criminal record, including an armed robbery in which held a gun to the stomach of a pregnant woman. In short, George Floyd was a real piece of shit. Moreover, putting a knee on an uncooperative suspect's neck is an approved police control technique, so how could Chauvin be indicted for murder? Finally, there was never any evidence that race played any role in Floyd's death. He was not arrested because he was black, but because he committed a crime. He was not forcibly restrained because he was black, but because he was uncooperative. Two of the four officers were non-white. The claim that race had anything to do with Floyd's death at all was simply a baseless assertion amplified and endlessly repeated by the media and BLM agitators. But now we know that it was all a fraud. What does the police body camera footage reveal? First of all, it reveals that George Floyd was dishonest, uncooperative, and acted deranged and scary. Floyd claimed that he had just lost his mother. He hadn't. He claimed to be too claustrophobic to get in the police car, which was a lie because he was not too claustrophobic to sit in his own car. He claimed twice that he was not on drugs, falsely. He refused repeatedly to allow the police to cuff him. He refused repeatedly to get in the police car. He claimed multiple times that he could not breathe before he ended up on the ground with Chauvin's knee on his neck. Obviously he was lying before that, so it made sense for Chauvin to disbelieve him when Floyd was on the ground. And, in any case, remember that the medical examiner said Floyd did not die of asphyxiation. Second, the video reveals that the police dealt with Floyd with a level of patience and professionalism that I certainly could not have mustered. One cannot say that Chauvin lost his patience or lashed out at Floyd. Ask yourself, dear reader, would you have been able to maintain your cool in the same situation? I know I would have snapped. I was thinking, couldn't we just arm police with tranquilizer darts to bring these beasts down? This video gives me nothing but respect for the police who have to deal day in and day out with deranged criminals like George Floyd. Was George Floyd a victim of injustice? No, he died because, 1, he committed a crime, 2, refused to comply with the police, and, 3, was so high on drugs that he was not up to the rigors of being forcibly arrested. If he hadn't done any of those things, he and a lot of other people would still be alive today. George Floyd's death was entirely his fault. It wasn't murder. It was the predictable result of Floyd's own bad character and bad choices. It was his just desserts. George Floyd got justice. Now we have to secure justice for Derek Chauvin and his fellow officers, as well as for the millions of Americans whose lives have been turned upside down by this massive hoax perpetrated by the government of Minneapolis, the state of Minnesota, Black Lives Matter, the mainstream media, and the far left aided and abetted by the craven eunuchs of the mainstream right. If I were Donald Trump, I would invoke the Insurrection Act, then spend the next few weeks arresting the leaders of BLM and Antifa, as well as their collaborators in state and municipal governments, for the crimes they have already committed. Once the leftist beast is decapitated, I would pardon Derek Chauvin and his fellow officers. Then I'd grab some popcorn. But we could never do that. Blacks would burn the country down. If that is your initial reaction, I want you to reflect on it. Derek Chauvin, his fellow officers, and the whole planet have been victimized by a blatant hoax. If we can't do the right thing and call a stop to it, then aren't we admitting that we have to choose between having justice and having black people in America? Well, I choose justice. Which is reason number 100 million and one why I believe that blacks and whites in America need to go our separate ways. We need a racial divorce.
Brother, I believe what you say, and we're going to pass this out around all to as many people as we can get it to. Well said. And that's it for today. I'll be back tomorrow on Freya's Day, Ladies' Day in the Bunker.